So as I mentioned a little bit earlier, today is Vaisakh, and the word Vaisakh doesn't mean anything as far as I am aware, it's just the name of the month, and but always remembered as the Buddha's birthday, or the Buddha, day of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and parinibbana. And the fact that these are celebrated on the same day is to me not a memory of a great cosmic coincidence, but is an expression of something which I think is very important, which is that the Buddha's life tells us something about the cyclical and the unified, more integrated nature of the teachings which the Buddha, and the truths which the Buddha realized. And of course, the insight into birth, aging, and death is a very integral part of the Four Noble Truths. So the fact that these all happen on one day, actually they're all happening at the same time. We're all, those three moments of birth, aging, and death are present in every moment. And of course, the crucial thing about the Buddha's life is birth, aging, and death. And if you look at the accounts of the Buddha's life, then you know he was born, and you know he was born pretty much in the same way that you and I were. There may be a few different differences, but basically pretty much in the same way. And he died pretty much in the same way. But in the meantime, he woke up. And that's really the difference, isn't it? That's the crucial thing about the Buddha's life, is that he actually woke up in the middle. And so many of us get born stupid, get old stupid, and die stupid. Yeah? Is there anything sadder than being old and stupid? Yeah? We all know that our bodies are going to fall apart when we get old. You know, we don't have any choice about that. And so if we get old and we haven't learned any wisdom in our life, that's pretty depressing, isn't it? Yeah? Being old and stupid. That would be something it's not, wouldn't want to look forward to. So we try to follow the Buddha's example and try to wake up in the middle somewhere. So I'd like to talk for this evening, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Buddha's life, what we can say about it, what we can't say about it, what we know, what we don't know, and what that might mean. It's a very large topic, and one which I've done quite a lot of study and research and contemplation on. And if we look at the way that the Buddhist scriptures are formed, the Buddhist teachings are formed, they're all formed within the Buddha's life. Every sutta says the Buddha was staying at Sarvati, or the Buddha was staying such and such, and then he said this and he said that. So every teaching is framed, is like an episode in the Buddha's life. It all derives its meaning from who this was, what he did, and there's always this kind of background understanding in all the teachings that this is the wisdom that comes from awakening. And so even the discourses, some of which are very simple and very straightforward. Yeah, there's many suttas which are just very simple, but they carry a weight and authority with them because they come from the Buddha's awakening. And so this story of the Buddha and his experience, his awakening, is absolutely central as something that gives meaning and gives weight, gives authority to the teachings. So it's important to understand what this story is, what it means, and what the implications of that are. Now, of course, we're dealing with events that happened 2,500 years ago. And there are a number of different approaches to this, okay? So there's a traditional approach, which is in terms of storytelling and legends and so on. And you can see if you go to any Buddhist temple, mostly that they'll have, like, the life of the Buddha will be depicted in pictures on the walls. kind of any introduction to Buddhism book will do the same thing. Or if you went to, say, the Buddhist Expo held by the Buddhist Council, they did a similar thing with the life of the Buddha and the different episodes and so on. And you can see this in even in the very ancient monuments in India, in Sanchi and other places, where they'll depict episodes carved in stone of the life of the Buddha. And obviously, you, very much a similar way to what was happening at the expo, that you would you know, the monk or whoever would come around with a group of people, and they'd come to each of the panels and use it as an explanation and a way of illustrating the stories and so on. And so this kind of mode of discourse has been happening for thousands of years. So this is one way of looking at the life of the Buddha. Another way of looking at the life of the Buddha is perhaps more characteristic of the Mahayana teachings, is where the Buddha, in terms of his historical phenomenon, is not so important, and the Buddha has more of a cosmic significance, more of a universal significance. And so if you follow Mahayana teachings or study the Mahayana teachings, then they'll often be talking about countless Buddhas and all of this Buddha and that Buddha and so on in different world systems or in our world system and so on. It gets very complicated. But I don't want to go into that system now, but just to point to what this, that way of thinking about it is less historically based. It's not so much interested in the question of, well, did these Buddhas actually exist in history? It's more looking at the kind of the meaning or the spiritual effect or impact that these stories and practices have on people, rather than being worried about whether these Buddhas actually exist in the world. So this is like one tendency, and sometimes that tendency can be criticized. You say, well, they've kind of lost their foundation in the reality of what actually happened. But in another sense, it's actually a very sophisticated approach, because it's also, it's in a sense, it's saying, well, let's not be so concerned about these historical details when, first of all, we don't really know what the historical details were anyway, and secondly, the facts of the matter are much less important in religion than the meaning or the effect that things have. So there's certainly something quite sophisticated in this approach that's used within the Mahayana schools. But nevertheless, for myself, I find myself drawn to an approach which is neither of those two I've talked about, and that is approach of the historical approach. It's my own sort of personality or my own tendency. I want to know the facts of the matter, and I sort of, first of all, I want to clarify what actually happened. Give me some hard evidence. Give me some rocks. I want to see some rocks. Let's say something, and I want to be able to hit them. Pick them up in my hands, you know, and then once we've got the rocks in our hands, we can then sort of start to see what they mean. Yeah. So let's just start this evening by seeing what kind of rocks we have in our hands. So, of course, it's always a good thing for anyone who's interested in Buddhist practice to go to India and to go to the holy sites. And if you haven't been, you should. And to get your hands on some of the rocks, yeah. Walk on the earth where the Buddha walked on, and you know, see the stones that are in those places. See the hills that the Buddha saw, the rivers that the Buddha sat by, and you get an impression of the land. It's actually a real land, real people living there. And so the Buddha was born, of course, in Lumbini, and the place we know where the Buddha was born, it's marked by an Ashokan pillar. And in the Ashokan pillar it says, Iha Buddhe Jate, which is in the Magadhan dialect, means, this is where the Buddha was born. Right? So that's pretty straightforward. Yeah? And very practical, put up by King Ashoka. He was a great visionary and also a very practical man. So he put this up and says, this is where the Buddha was born. It's a great spiritual place, a great holy place, a great place of pilgrimage. And in honor of this great place, we're going to free the local village from all taxes. Yeah? So it's very canny, isn't it? Yeah. So he set it up as like a tourist destination. It's like a duty-free zone. And encouraging local prosperity. So it's Lumbini. And according to the legend that the Buddha's mother, Maya, was on her way home from, she was married to Suddhodana, one of the leaders of the Shakyan clan at Kapilavastu, and when she was came near the time to give birth, she travelled back from Kapilavastu to her hometown, which was some distance away. She was from the Kaliya clan. And this actually is quite a realistic detail. It actually features quite commonly in stories of that time, and it does seem that it was the practice at that time for the pregnant mothers to return back to their families to give birth. It was quite a common thing. Obviously, it must have been quite difficult for them. And as again happens quite often in the stories, that Maya didn't quite make it, that she gave birth halfway, right, between one place and the other. Now, this is actually quite interesting, okay? So this is an interesting little detail, that giving birth on a journey, yeah? And again, this is quite a classic motif. You think about Jesus, for example, yeah? Giving birth in a stable, very much the same kind of thing. Neither in one place nor the other, yeah? In between the father's place and the mother's place, yeah? Halfway, yeah? Traveling. And so this is one of the motifs in the Buddha's life, which is a classic part of mythology and legends. It's all that the fact that doesn't mean that it didn't happen, right? It just means that it has a particular storytelling context. Again, according to the story, Maya went into the grove of Lumbini. And it's interesting that the little detail in the story says she went into the grove to play. And she said to the people she was travelling with, you know, she said, oh, I want to go into the park to play. You imagine that, huh? So she was probably quite young, yeah? We know very, very little about the Buddha's family, right? Almost everything that you think you know is actually the product of legends that are many, many hundreds of years after the Buddha's life. So if you really want to know some facts, if you want to get some rocks in your hands, you have to sort of wipe the slate pretty much clean. We don't know how old Maya was, but I think she was probably quite young. We don't even really know that her name was Maya. Her name Maya is mentioned once in the early Buddhist scriptures. Okay? Once. Maya, of course, is quite a common Indian name, right? So it's not unlikely. But also, the name Maya means illusion, right? It means magic. Yeah, and Maya means illusion. Yeah? So illusion went to play in the park, yeah? And then gave birth to the Buddha. Yeah, that's what it says. Yeah. The play of illusion in the park, and then the Buddha is born. I find that quite interesting. You can take that historically and literally if you want, yeah, or perhaps it means something else. Anyway, and according to again in the accounts of the Buddha's birth, and there's many, many sort of miracles that happened. You know, the ground shook and trembled and light appeared in the sky and the devas are coming and so on and so forth. And these are all fairly conventional things. You see in the most common representation of the Buddha's mother is she's standing and she's holding the branch of the sal tree as she gave birth standing up. And that image of her standing as she gave birth is one of the most common and characteristic of the Buddhist imagery in ancient India. And it's very, very connected with the whole. It's actually a stereotype image which is found not just as a Buddhist image, but also in the Indian tradition as a whole, called the Salabhanjika, and it was an image of fertility and abundance. So the Buddha was born in Lumbini, and then went to live back in Kapalavastu. Now, when I mentioned that the episode or the details, and many of the details of Buddha's life are very similar to that found in mythology and legends of many great heroes. And I'm sure many of you be familiar with the work by Joseph Campbell, the hero with a thousand faces, or something like that. A story about the hero's journey. Yeah, and it's definitely well worth a read if you haven't read that. But Joseph Campbell actually uses the story of the Buddha as one of his main examples for the legend of the hero and the story of the hero. And basically, the idea of the Campbell's book is that if you look at any great hero, whether political heroes, warriors, or spiritual heroes, or whatever, that their stories, their life stories, tend to fall into certain patterns. It doesn't mean the pattern's always exactly the same, but there are certain motifs which you find again and again and again and again, and which have a certain meaning within the life. And the creativity expresses itself in how those things are arranged and how they manifest in one particular example. And there's no denying that the Buddha's life actually falls into that paradigm very, very closely. And that applies not just to the late developed versions of the Buddha's myth, but even to the very earliest way it's found within the Pali Canon. It's not so explicit there, but you still find most of the episodes of the hero's journey is found within the Buddha's life, even in the Pali Canon. And so that means that there's a, what's happening is that there's an interplay between, fact and meaning. Okay, so there's an interplay. Buddha, in one sense, was an actual historical person, and there were certain particular events that happened in his life, and that story is a memory of those events. But there's also, I think, there's also a probably more important or equally important thing is, what did those events mean for the people? Yeah, how did they affect people? How did they become? How did that story of one man's life become something that was of intrinsic and essential value to everybody's life? That's the trick, and that's what turns just an anecdote or a biography into a myth and into an archetype which has meaning for everyone. So the hero's journey is something which has meaning for everyone and doesn't just have meaning within one person's life. Yeah? And so that's why these motifs and these archetypes are read into it, and it's told in those kinds of ways. And so you find that these kind of archetypes are gradually introduced into the Buddha's birth. So, for example, you have the one of the classic ones is the virgin birth. Okay, so we're familiar, of course, with the virgin birth of Jesus, but this is one of the motifs that's found constantly through different heroes, that they're in some way are said to be a virgin birth. And this was also the case in the Buddha's life, that if you read many of the accounts of the Buddha's life, it actually says that Suddhodana was not sleeping with Maya on the night that she conceived, and that she conceived by having a dream, and the dream was of a white elephant which entered into her. And so many of the accounts actually say that. And it's interesting that this is not just to point this out, it's not just a modern development, but there's actually an argument in ancient Rome, about, I think, 300 or 400 AD, between some of the pagans and the Christians, and they're arguing about the motif of the virgin birth of Jesus. And some of the pagans were saying, well, actually, you know, that it's not just Jesus who's said to be a virgin birth, but there's all these other heroes and religious leaders and gods and so on were supposed to have virgin births, and they listed them all, and the Buddha was one of them. Okay, so the ancient Romans were already using the Buddha in this context, you know, in about 300-400 AD. So this is one of those examples. So there are some of these examples where you think, well, okay, genetically I think it's unlikely that it was actually a virgin birth, right? Most likely the facts of biology tend to sort of weigh it to the other side. The Buddha was supposed to sort of stand up on his feet and take 7 mighty strides to the north, and then roar out with the voice of a bull, I am the eldest in the world, I am the greatest in the world. Yeah? So, did that happen? Yeah? Well, I can't prove it one way or the other. Yeah? Certainly would have been astonishing if it did. And you see that the very cute pictures of the baby Buddha with his finger held up in the air. Have you seen those? And he's standing up and he's holding his finger. That's like I'm the greatest in the world. Yeah. So he's allowed to say that because he really was the greatest in the world. So he's not being arrogant or conceited. It's okay if you really are. It's like Muhammad Ali. Yeah. He could say I'm the greatest. He was. It's all right. So it's likely that it seems to me that if we look at the account of the Buddha's birth, that almost the entire detail, almost everything about it, has this kind of luminous halo, this kind of glow of unreality around it. It's like it's all been constructed out of CGI, yeah? It doesn't look real. It looks fake, except for maybe a few details. Probably the detail that he's born in Lumbini. Probably the detail that his mother was Maya and that she was on her way home. Probably, and this is another one of the realistic details, that his mother died after 7 days. Okay? Or at least maybe it's conventional time, but at least that she died shortly after. We know that the Buddha was brought up by Mahapajapati, it's Maya's sister. And we also know that it's very common for women to die in childbirth or to die of the complications of childbirth. It was a very, very normal thing in those days, and still is today in many parts of the world. So that particular part of the Buddha's birth. And the other interesting thing is that there's one place in the suttas where the Buddha and Ananda are discussing his birth, and it doesn't mention any of the miracles or anything like that. It only mentions the fact that Maya died after 7 days. So it seems to me there's a good reason to think that that's maybe one of the historical kernels that underlies that. It's also worthy to note that those discussions of the Buddha's birth are almost always, the stories of the Buddha's birth are almost always in a discussion between the Buddha and Ananda. Okay? So Ananda was the one who was behind the whole biographical tradition of the Buddha. Yeah? And it seems that Ananda was the one who was more impressed by all the miracles and stuff like that. And it's from him, not necessarily from him personally, but from his tradition or his school, that this tendency developed. So the Buddha, I'm going to assume, most likely had a relatively normal birth. Probably that there were some medical complications and his mother probably died after 7 days. And I suspect that fact had a very profound psychological influence on the young Siddhartha's mind as he was growing up. Yeah? The death of his mother after 7 days. Yeah? So maybe somebody who knew more about childhood development and psychology might be able to reflect on that some more, but I find that very significant. Anyway, so the Buddha then went back to Kapilavatthu, or Siddhartha then went back to Kapilavatthu. There were the usual kinds of predictions that he was going to become a Buddha and so on and so forth, which again are standard motifs all in the life of the hero and the various episodes of him displaying various kinds of feats when he was a child and being, you know, the best at all of the arts and the sports and everything like this. And these again are very standard parts of a hero's journey. And again, within all of that story, there's probably, I think, one detail in the Buddha's childhood which is likely to be actually historically based, and that is the event where he sat underneath the rose apple tree and went into the first jhana. And now the reason I think that episode is likely to be authentic is firstly because it's mentioned very widely across the Buddhist scriptures. It's mentioned by the Buddha himself as an intrinsic part of his awakening experience, okay, in those very central and authentic suttas, but also because I think it's something which is very realistic. Yeah, just like the detail of Maya dying after 7 days, I think is very realistic. I think mothers died very frequently. I also think it's very realistic to say that children, people, especially people who are naturally spiritual and have a naturally spiritual inclination, should somehow naturally fall into these states of samadhi and meditation. It happens. Yeah, I've heard various stories about it. I don't find it to be at all implausible. And so this story is that the Siddhartha was just sitting gently underneath the rose apple tree, and his father was off working, and he just went into that state of samadhi. And what seems to me striking about that episode is the very gentleness and very naturalness about it. He doesn't go into that state of meditation by like forcing himself. He's not trying to achieve anything. He's not trying to get a particular state. He's not trying to get a particular power or get reborn anywhere. He's not trying to solve any problems. Yeah? He's not meditating in order to do anything. He's just being peaceful, sitting in nature. That's all. And who is there among us today who has not, at some time or another, felt that sense of peace when they're in nature? Yeah? And that sense of peace that comes from exactly that, from not wanting to do anything, not wanting to get anything, not trying to meditate, not trying to be this or be that, and just being at peace. And that's that peace that Buddha found, or that Siddhartha found. But I think the problem was at that stage that he didn't know what to do with it. He didn't. There was no understanding. There was no context. It was just something that happened. Yeah. And so these things, I'm sure these kinds of things happen fairly, not uncommonly to people, but for the most part, it's just something that happens and maybe has some kind of effect or whatever, but we don't really know how to understand it or interpret it, so we just kind of get on with our lives. So again, there are many, many, many stories told about young Siddhartha's young life, but I'll pass over them now because I don't think any of them have a particularly strong historical background. When we come to the Buddha's adult life, there's good reason to show that the Buddha had a son, okay? So the Buddha's son Rahula is featured in the Buddhist scriptures quite prominently and so on, and so there's no, I think, reason to doubt that he had a son. And so if he had a son, then presumably he had a wife. We know much less about the Buddha's family than we think we know. The Buddha's wife is often called Yashodhara, but actually in the earliest scriptures, she's just called Rahula Mata, which means Rahula's mother. That was a very common way that mothers would be referred to, yeah? And in the same way that sons like Sariputta just means the son of Sari, yeah? So Rahula Mata is just what she's called. So we don't actually really know what her name was. And even though she's often called Yashodhara, I've done a little bit of research on that point, and I've found, I don't know, maybe a dozen different names by which she's known in ancient texts. It's a bit shocking, isn't it? Yeah? And there's no actual reason to think that any of them are correct, really. It may be the case that all of them are just more or less inventions by the later tradition, and that the only thing we know from the early texts is that she was called Rahula's mother. She's almost like disappeared. As a person, she's almost disappeared. She just performs a function of being the Buddha's wife and Rahula's mother, so she can play a role within the Buddha's life story. But actually, who she is as a person is something, I think, which has become inaccessible to us. We know very little about it. There are verses attributed to her in the Therigatha, which may be the closest we come to actually her personal expression. But we don't know very much about her. We don't know what kind of marriage that they have. And again, their marriage was presented in very archetypal terms, in terms of a contest, a marriage competition, and so on. If you read other Indian mythology like Mahabharata and others, you'll find exactly the same kinds of stories there. Anyway, they were married, had the kid Rahula, and of course you all know the story of the Buddha being protected from his father, not being able to see any signs of aging and sickness and so on. And again, all of these details came into the tradition at a later date. There's no particular evidence that they were part of the early story of the Buddha's life. And you'll also be familiar with the kind of the very poignant episode of the Buddha kind of looking in on Rahula, the newborn baby, yeah, being born on the night of his departure, and the Buddha just looking in and thinking, saying, "Oh, a fetter has been born to me." That's where the name Rahula came from. Yeah, so it's a very kind of poignant story. But these are all the soap opera kind of aspects of the Buddha's life. They're kind of tugging at the heartstrings, getting an emotional response out of it. So it's very effective in that way. Actually, Rahula doesn't mean fetter. Okay, so this is a kind of a slight trip up for that little explanation, is that the word Rahula doesn't have anything to do with the meaning of fetter. Actually, it's related to the Rahu, who was the demon who was supposed to swallow the sun and the moon. So in ancient Indian cosmology, whenever they'd have an eclipse, they would say that Rahu has swallowed the sun and swallowed the moon. And so Rahula is a name which reflects that. It may be that he was born around the time of an eclipse. So Rahula's born, the Buddha goes off, he abandons his family. Oh my goodness. What do you normally say about a bloke who just walks out on his wife and child?
Can you tell us what Rahula means?
Rahula, that's what I was just saying. Rahula, it's associated with Rahula, who's the demon who swallowed the sun and the moon. That's what they say, but it doesn't actually have anything to do with the meaning of impediment. That's just a storytelling device. Yeah. Rahul is actually quite a common name in India. And it's not that common for parents to call their children impediments. Yeah? Let's hear my delightful children, obstacle, impediment, and barrier. What is?
Having children.
Well, exactly. So that would be more.
Ultimately.
Yeah. So the bloke who leaves home and abandons his wife and children. Terrible, isn't it? No, seriously. I mean, if it wasn't the Buddha, yeah. So you're all conflicted now because you want the Buddha to be a nice guy, right? We all want the Buddha to be a nice guy, but then he did this thing. I mean, normally, you know, the word you use normally for somebody who does that kind of thing, it begins with B and ends with arsed. And you know, there's no two ways about it. Yeah? So what? What's going on? Well, is it just that he? That's really cruel, isn't it? Poor old Yashodhara. What does she feel like? What about Rahula having to grow up without a dad? Yeah, that's not very nice. So this is one of those episodes in the story, which has to be dealt with. Okay. And it's precisely those tensions which actually create the interest in the story. They actually give the meaning to the story. If the story doesn't have that kind of tension, if it's all just entirely smooth and rational and sensible and easy, then it's completely boring. Yeah, it's the very fact that there's that moment of that where it crystallizes it, where you can crystallize that moment of the Buddha looking in and seeing his beautiful wife sleeping there with a newborn baby, and you can see that whole situation is crystallized there in a moment of you know, is our place in the world, is our place looking after a family and our children, or is our place retreating into solitude, into meditation? And that whole kind of spiritual dilemma, which is so much a part of that moment-to-moment choice, that's crystallized there very beautifully in that very powerful, very emotive moment. So you have to feel the pain of it, right? So you can try to rationalize it if you like, but to me, rationalizing it is missing the point. Okay, so you can say, oh well, you know, the Buddha knew that the son, you know, there was an extended family and that they were very wealthy and that there would be somebody to bring up the son and so on and so forth. So you can try to explain it away, but to me, the very point is that tension that you have there. And even though it's dressed up as a story, but the reality of it must have been something like that. Okay. We know that he had a son, yeah, and presumably he must have had a wife, and so there must have been a separation, yeah. So that choice had to be made. Whether it happened in exactly that way is another matter. Actually, in the earlier scriptures, it doesn't say anything about that. In the earlier scriptures, it says, "Mata pitunang rodantanang," even though my mother and father wept with tears running down their faces. Okay. That's the phrase in the earlier suttas. Yeah, I went forth, even though my mother and father wept with tears running down their face. So that's not really consistent with the developed story, is it? Because in the developed story, he snuck out in the middle of the night and he didn't know that anyone. He was crying or anything. And also in the developed story, it's not really the mother and father who are the main players, but the wife and son. Nevertheless, it's a similar idea that there was the pain of that separation. So that has to be dealt with. And in telling the story, if you look at it, you know, this is it's all of these moments, which is where the storyteller has to enter into it and has to sort of tell it one way or another, and the story has to deal with that situation in one way or another. Okay, and you find that if you look at different ways that it's told, that the different storytellers will deal with that situation in different ways. So, for example, in one of the versions, in the Mulasavasivada version, that she didn't actually give birth to Rahula at that time. The Buddha left before she gave birth to Rahula. And when he left, when they were at the palace in Kapilavastu, they were continually getting news back from the Buddha about how his practice was going. Okay, so and then whenever he would do certain practices, Yashodhara would do the same practice in the palace. So when he was like fasting, then she would fast. When he was like going without sleeping, she would go without sleeping and so on. And she did exactly the same practices for 6 years, right? Without giving birth. Okay? So she was pregnant for 6 years, yeah? And while the Buddha was doing all of these self-torment practices and things like that, and she did exactly the same thing. And then, on the night that he became enlightened, then she gave birth. Yeah? It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah? So, I mean, again, it's not something that's meant to be taken literally, yeah? But it's something which is very interesting in terms of, like, showing how the storytellers wrestled with that whole idea of these two people and their relationship, yeah? Another version of the story is very interesting, that when this time that they had given birth and Yashoda had given birth and was holding the baby, and Siddhartha looks in and he's about to go, and she knows he's about to go, right? And she says to him, "Sid." Oh God, she would have got a kid. She said, "Sid." <"Did." laughs> Take me with you. Where you're going. Take me to that place where you're going. Yeah? And this is another one of those moments which is the crux of stories. And if you're familiar with Indian story, then probably the most well known of all the Indian stories is the Ramayana. The Ramayana is the story of Rama and Sita, who are like the ideal wife and husband. And the story of the Ramayana echoes in many ways the story of the Buddha in slightly different forms, okay? But this moment, again, Rama is leaving the palace, not because he's going forth to practice spiritually, but because he's been sent into exile. There's been intrigues in the palace and so on, and he's been sent into exile until the time comes for him to return and become the king. And Rama is a worldly hero rather than a spiritual hero like the Buddha. And so he's being sent off, and Sita says, "Take me with you." Yeah, it's exactly the same. The crux of the thing is exactly the same. Take me with you. And so there's this kind of moment, and Rama says, "No, I can't take you with you. It's going to be dangerous in the forest." And Sita says, "No, a woman's place is by her husband's side. Yeah, I must go with you. I'm going to look after you." He says, "No, I can't." And she says, "Yes, I can." He says, "No, you can't." She says, "Yes, I can." And again, in the different tellings of the Ramayana, there's always this great argument between them, and of course Sita always prevails, and Sita always goes with Rama into the forest, and they live there and have various adventures and so on. And so this is a different, you know, it's resolved, it's the same crisis, but it's resolved in a different way. Yeah. And one of the lovely things about the story of Rama and Sita is that in one of the tellings of that tale, and they're arguing about it, and finally Sita completely blows the top, completely loses her temper, and says to Rama, "You know, how can you possibly go off into the forest and leave me behind? The Ramayana has been told thousands of times before this, and every single time Sita goes into the forest with Rama. Yeah? How can you leave me behind now?" So of course that's a completely irrefutable argument. Again, it's pointing to there's a necessity, you know? It's something that has to take place for the story to happen. These things have to happen. For the story to happen, the Buddha has to leave his wife and his family. Yeah? Otherwise, the story wouldn't happen. We wouldn't be listening to it. And so the Buddha leaves. Yashoda says, "Take me to that place where you go, Sid." And he says, "I will." Yeah, he says, I will take you there. And then he goes. Yeah? So to me, this is a very, very beautiful moment, yeah? Because, of course, he did. Yeah, he came back later in his life, and he taught his family and his wife and so on, and according to the tradition, that she became an arahant, became enlightened. And so she went to that place. She went to Nibbana, the same place that the Buddha went to. Yeah? So it's a very, very beautiful story, very beautiful way of putting it, you know, and showing how for the narrators, in the times of old, that there are different ways of recognizing that very, very poignant moment of that separation. So, the Buddha went forth. Now, the earliest form of telling the Buddha's going forth is told in a very, very obscure sutta in the Atthakavagga of the Sutta Nipata called the Atthadanda Sutta. And I strongly recommend that you should have a look at that sutra. It's only a short one, but it's very interesting because that particular section of the suttas is one which has been identified by every scholar of early Buddhism as the most authentic accounts of the Buddha, and of all the passages, perhaps the most to actually represent the Buddha's actual words, literal words. And yet the account of the going forth that he gives there is quite different from the account told in the traditions, and it's one which is almost completely overlooked. And what he points to there, he doesn't talk about the story of going and seeing the old man, the sick man, and the corpse and so on. And he talks there, he says, I saw how much conflict there was in the world. Yeah? I saw people fighting and opposing each other. Yeah? Like, and I saw that existence was like a fish flopping round in a dried up stream, that there wasn't any place to find a place. I looked everywhere I could find, and I could find nowhere a place of safety. Yeah? Every direction appeared like it was unstable and shaking and trembling. And so it was this sense of like conflict in the world, the sense of insecurity and instability in the world, was the thing which drove him to go forth. And it doesn't go into the details of that. You know, why was that? Was there war? Was there conflict within the clan or the family? What was the trigger to that? But it seems like there was probably some kind of social background to that, which would have triggered that. And it certainly was very normal in Indian society that there was a very unstable and conflictive political landscape. So he went forth, practiced for 6 years, and had two main directions in his practice. The first, he went with what were probably sages practicing within the yogic or Upanishadic tradition, practicing very high levels of formless attainments, and then with yogis practicing within the ascetic tradition, very similar to the Jaina tradition of self-mortification. And he rejected both of those, and he came back to his own intuitive awareness. And the key moment, the key breakthrough moment, was when he recollected his experience of jhana when he was a child. And then in Sutta says, could that be the way to enlightenment? And then the insight, the intuition, came to him, eso mago bodhaya, eso wa mago bodhaya. That indeed is the path to enlightenment. And so it's like this intuitive intuition that just comes to him. That's the way. And again, for me, this is one of those moments in these stories which strikes me as being particularly realistic. Yeah? In psychologically, that's how the mind works. It just comes to you in a moment. You know, the question is there, which you can maybe he spent 6 years striving and struggling and trying to do everything he can to realize enlightenment, and then all of a sudden, when the mind's ready, it just comes to him. Ah, that is the path to enlightenment. And until that time, he wasn't ready to address that. So he goes to sit under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. Again, this is very well recognized from an early time, the Ashokan edicts, which are only 150 years or 200 years after the Buddha's passing away, refer to the site at Bodh Gaya. So it's likely that that was the actual place of his enlightenment. And he sat down under the Bodhi tree and got enlightened. First of all, he got the grass cutter to put down a nice soft seat of grass under him. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So again, all these kinds of legends that are around this episode. You know, he sat down in different places, and then the earth wasn't strong enough to bear him, and the weight of his determination, and so on. So then all the kind of legends and the Mara's battles, and all of these kinds of things which you see depicted in the artwork all the time. But again, the account in the early scriptures is quite straightforward and quite, he sat down, went into meditation, and developed what they call the three knowledges, the Tre Vidya. Now, the time of his enlightenment, of sitting overnight in meditation, he became enlightened towards the dawn. Now, that period is described in quite a few different suttas from different angles, okay? So one of the aspects of the Dhamma is that the truth of the Dhamma can be expressed in different ways. But perhaps the most common or the most characteristic way of expressing that is in terms of the three knowledges, the Tre Vidya. The knowledge of recollecting his past lives, knowledge of seeing how beings die and get reborn according to their karma, and then finally the knowledge of the Four Noble Truths and the ending of defilements. So these are very powerfully interconnected insights and knowledges. Now, unfortunately, I don't have time this evening to go into these in detail, but essentially this is the answer to that question which stimulated the whole search. And one of the most important discourses, or probably the most important discourse to talk about this, is called the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, which literally means the spiritual quest, the story of the spiritual quest, or the story of the noble adventure. And there he said he was consumed by this need to find why should I, being subject to birth, aging and death, seek that which is also subject to birth, aging and death? Why shouldn't I seek that which is not subject to birth, aging and death? And so this was the consuming drive behind his whole spiritual search, and that's what he found on that night, was that which goes beyond birth, aging and death, that which is, doesn't partake in birth, aging and death. And so this, he was not satisfied with anything short of that. And so this is what we call the enlightenment. So from that time, he was 35 years old. From that time, he was known as the Buddha. And he spent the rest of his life, the remaining 45 years of his life, teaching. And again, there's no time to go into details of what happened after his enlightenment and so on. But after that 45-year period, and then the time comes for his passing away. And the passing away is told in very, very poignant terms in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So it's just worth reflecting and worth noting that when we look at the Buddha's birth, what we have is an almost entirely mythical account which has been basically told by Ananda, pretty much, okay? Or Ananda's school. And is almost entirely sort of sparkly with the glow of legendary elaboration. When it comes to the story of the Buddha's own quest and spiritual practice, what we find is much more prosaic and straightforward descriptions which are from the Buddha himself. Yeah? And then again, when we come to the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the story of the ending of the Buddha's life, we find a mixture of the actual teachings which the Buddha gave from time to time, and then a connected narrative which tells, for the most part, a coherent and realistic depiction of travelling on a journey and the different events that happened to the Buddha as he went on. In other words, the story of the Buddha's death and around that time is much more realistic than the story of the Buddha's birth. Okay? What that says to me is, you think about it in terms of perspective. Now, if we're 2,000 years, right, away, 2,500 years away from these events, both the Buddha's birth and the death appear almost equally distant to us. Right? They're both over there, and they're both way, way back in time. But if the Buddha's birth is told in very, very mythical terms, and the death is told in fairly realistic terms, then that suggests to me that whoever was telling that story was situated fairly close to the events, that it was maybe told by somebody who was actually there at the time of the Buddha's death and who participated in those events and who had a memory of those, but who didn't have much of a memory of the Buddha's birth and used a lot more imagination in that account. Yeah? And so I think it's actually very likely that these stories were actually put together by Ananda himself. He lived for about 40 years after the Buddha passed away. And I think the kernel of these discourses, especially in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, were put together by Ananda, who's the main character in the story apart from the Buddha, and he's always kind of wandering around with the Buddha and always kind of messing things up. You know, he's like the C-3PO of the story. He's always kind of bumbling around, and the Buddha says, "Go and get me some water." He says, "No, no, you don't want that water." He says, "Yeah, get me the water." And he says, "No, I don't want to get the water." And the Buddha sort of says, "Well, you know, by the way, if I wanted to, I could live for another billion years, you know, until the end of the universe, you know, just by the way." "You know, by the way, imagine, you know, I could live to the end of the universe if you like, you know, by the way. You know, Ananda, by the way, just to let you know, I could live until the end of the universe if I wanted to, you know." And Ananda didn't say anything. And finally he says, "Oh yeah, well look, that would be really good if you could live to the end of the universe, you know." He says, no, it's too late now. I already hinted three times and he didn't say anything. He says, "Go on." He says, "No." He says, "Oh please." He says, "No way." So Ananda is always kind of, you know, got this kind of thing, and you know, can be seen. It's just my speculation, really, but it can be seen in a sense of Ananda's own sort of sense of humility or sort of questioning, like his role in with that great teacher. But what's very beautiful about the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which for the most part is a very realistic account of events, is just Buddha's old, And, you know, there's again these episodes which strike me as being particularly vivid and realistic, you know, where the Buddha's sitting in the evening sun and letting the sun warm his back because he's got, you know, he's got a bad back, and the Buddha Ananda remarks on how old he's looking and so on. And these are not the kind of things which are kind of a past normally of a legendary elaboration of somebody's life. Yeah, these are the kinds of things which are the remarks of somebody who knew somebody and a memory of an event that they had, you know, like, you know, I visited my old uncle and there he was sitting in the sunset on his rocking chair on the porch. And so to me, these kinds of things strike quite a vivid note, and it's very touching, very moving narrative of the Buddha just wandering from place to place, teaching where he went, teaching the bhikkhus, encouraging them. And it's very gently told. It's very subtle, but to me very, very moving. And so there are many interesting aspects of that teaching. Eventually the Buddha comes to Kusinara and arranges and tells Ananda that he's going to die there and so on, and the people come to see him, and many people coming and weeping and wailing and so on. And one of the very, very crucial things at that point is something that's repeated again and again, is that you say that it says like the arahants would be very impassive and very equanimous, and that they would just say, what has come to be has come to be, what is going to pass away will pass away, how could it be otherwise? And then those who are not enlightened would weep and wail, roll around on the ground and beating their breasts and crying, the eye of the world has vanished, the eye of the world is vanishing. So there's this very great split, this great dichotomy in the community, in their relationship with the Buddha's passing away. And again, this, to me, this is a memory of something that's very realistic within the Buddhist community, yeah? Which I think we all feel within outside ourselves. On the one hand, we understand, yes, this is the nature of things to pass, but on the other hand, you still feel this emotional response. Yeah, so could well have been a genuine historical phenomenon, but also is very reflective of an inner emotional turmoil which we feel as Buddhists to kind of grapple realistically with these kinds of issues. So the Buddha, just before he passed away, then there's a number of, again, very, very simple and very poignant things that he said just before he passed away. One of them, he said, he said, does anybody have any doubts about the teaching? Yeah? And nobody said anything. Yeah? And then he said, okay, well look, if you know, maybe you might be too nervous to say something, so if you feel like you have any doubts, then let a friend speak to a friend. Yeah? Just tell the person next to you, and then they can ask the question if you feel too nervous to ask it for yourself. So to me, that's a very, very beautiful, you know, that he was so considerate and so extending this right up until that last time. Yeah, but it was very, very beautiful. And so he said, even at that time, that nobody had any doubts about the teaching at that time. And so there were a few other things the Buddha said, was supposed to have said on the time of his death, which I won't go into too much. One of them, he laid down a disciplinary means for Channa, who was the Buddha's ex-charioteer, who had been was very full of pride and conceit and wouldn't let anybody admonish him or tell him what to do. So the Buddha said, okay, give him the silent treatment. Can you imagine that? I mean, that must have been pretty devastating. You know, the Buddha's just about to die. Everybody's there. The last thing that the Buddha does virtually is to say, give a punishment against this poor guy. He must have been mortified when he heard about it. So he did this, and of course later on when Channa heard about the punishment, he felt very, very, he did feel very mortified, felt very remorseful, and went to ask for forgiveness and eventually became enlightened. And then the Buddha's last words, of course, vaya dhamma sankhara apamadena sampadeta. Vaya dhamma sankhara means basically means things fall apart. Vaya dhamma sankhara, yeah. Literal translation is all conditioned phenomena are subject to decay, which is kind of the Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, Buddhist hybrid English version of it. And the normal English version of it, things fall apart. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. As Monty Python said, things just fall apart in every way. So, and then apamadena sampadeta, yeah, again the literal translation of it, strives on with diligence, yeah. So a more kind of normal English translation would be something like just keep trying, yeah, or don't stop, yeah. So this, in a way, this is these four words in Pali, it's just four words: vaya dhamma, sankhara, apamadena, sampadeta. Four words, it absolutely sums up the Buddha's whole teaching. Yeah, and the first part, vaya dhamma, sankhara, is the whole teaching on impermanence, on suffering, on dependent origination, on this nature of the world which the Buddha was faced in, which he said was the reason he went forth in the first place, is that everything is insecure and unstable. Yeah. That's what he said, that's why he went forth. Vaya dhamma sankhara, everything is falling apart. And then the response to that, do something about it. Yeah? Don't ever stop. Don't ever give up. Don't be lazy. Yeah? Vaya dhamma sankhara, apamadena sampadeta. So these were the Buddha's last words. And to me, it encapsulates so beautifully the Buddha's teaching. So then, according to the account, the Buddha went into various jhanas, different states of meditation, passed away in the Parinibbana, and then, as there must be, there was the world shook and the light appeared and the earthquakes happened and all of those kinds of things, and various gods came down and gave various verses and so on. And so those events are as may be. The other thing that happened, of course, they then had the funeral and they cremated the Buddha, and they then nearly had a war over the Buddha's relics. So it strikes me as being another extremely realistic detail. The great teacher's just passed away, the great prophet of peace. What's the first thing you do? Fight. He said his whole life, don't worry about my physical body, this is not me, you know, my teachings is the important thing, practice my teaching. Don't come and, you know, look and think you get some special blessing by looking at me and my physical form or whatever. And then what do? The guys, we're going to go and fight over his bones. Crikey. Anyway, so they managed to avert actually killing each other over the Buddha's bones, which is good. But they, according to the accounts, have divided it up into 10 sections and built stupas for them and so on. So this is another story, is the division of the relics and so on. If you really do want to see the Buddha's, what they call the Amisa Dhatu, the physical relics of the Buddha, you can see in the New Delhi Museum, and they have the bones from Kapalavastu. Recovered from the stupa there, which very likely are the bones of the Buddha himself. Everything else which you see as Buddha relics are probably best to be put in a couple of quote marks, but the ones in the New Delhi Museum are very likely to be the real thing. So very briefly, this is the life of the Buddha, in some sense, as can be gleaned, some of the details that can be gleaned from history, and some reflections on the meaning of that in terms of the Buddha's teachings and in terms of how it meant for Buddhist practitioners. So that's my little talk for you this Waisak. So I offer this for your reflection. And like the Buddha, if you have any questions, any doubts, then please, you can whisper it to your friends. Yeah?
You mentioned again that the death of Siddhartha's mother, when Siddhartha was very young, might have had some impact on the young child.
Yeah.
And that sort of seems to me to, in a way, conflict with the idea that suddenly one day Siddhartha as a young man should realize that people die, people get sick, people grow old.
Mm.
That sort of story, that part of the story sounds a little, to my mind, unrealistic.
Well, no, I think, like, I think that impact when he was a young, an infant would be possibly completely subconscious.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think there comes a time for everyone that we realize a sense of loss and so on. But I think maybe it was more poignant for him. you know, maybe it was more powerful for him for that very reason.
I just wanted to make clear, were you saying that there is scant historical evidence from the text that that event might have actually happened in terms of the foresight?
Yeah, almost certainly. The foresight didn't happen.
Okay.
The story of the foresight is told in the suttas, is told in the story of Vipassi Bodhisattva, not in the story of Siddhartha at all. So the story of Vipassi Bodhisattva is told in the Mahapadana Sutta, which again is very closely associated with Ananda, and it's the story of a Buddha in a past Buddha era. And so it's quite explicitly a mythological text. You know, everything is like, you know, they lived for tens of thousands of years and all of these kinds of things. So it's quite, you know, explicitly a mythological text. And so within that context, I mean, the whole idea, of course, that you can grow up, especially in India, without seeing any sick people is quite ridiculous, right? But it's a way of illustrating. It's a narrative which makes that point very vivid. But it's not told about Siddhartha until much later. Yeah. There are many, many events like that. Another one is the episode with the female musicians, where he was supposed to see the female musicians and become sleeping and you know, drooling and so on, and he became a little yuck. So, but that event, that was actually told originally of a fellow called Yasa, who was one of the Buddha's early disciples. And again, that exactly the same event is told in the Ramayana. So it's a kind of standard motif in Indian storytelling. And sort of adopt a lot of those episodes were kind of adopted into the Buddha's own life story.
About that point, I thought that when you are dead, because his mom was dead, when he decided to leave, he may have thought, well, I didn't have a mother, or my birth mother died, so, and I turned out okay, so why can't I just leave?
He might have given thanks for his dysfunctional childhood.
Well, yeah, he might have thought, it'll be alright, I'm okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So it gave him an excuse, in a way.
Well, I mean, you know, we laugh about it, but it's very normal that when we're as adults, we play out the patterns that we experience when we're children. Yeah,
yeah, so
absolutely.
You grow up feeling
abandoned,
maybe, that's just what happened.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, I do feel that those events, they're certainly connected. You know, I mean, when that's told to Ananda, right? When the Ananda and the Buddha are discussing the fact that the Buddha's mother passed away after 7 days, right? There's one very short sutra in the Anguttara Nikaya. Buddha and Ananda are discussing this, and there's no lights appearing in the sky or lotuses springing up from the ground or anything like that. It's just talking about the fact that the Buddha's mum died after 7 days, and the Buddha reflecting, yeah, well, you know, that's how things are. You know, whatever is born must age and must pass away. So it's, you know, it's quite clearly that he's using that as that kind of reflection for that notion of separation and sadness of life. Yeah.
And another point on the mythology around the dream and stuff like that, it's a little bit phallically
involved. Oh, very much so, yeah.
So because they're all a bit hung up, maybe even at times they do about, I don't know, sex being bad or whatever, it's a tainting for God who live beyond it. You know, it's sort of still in there with the symbolism, but it's not explicit. So she just had a dream.
Oh, look, absolutely.
That makes one of the raunchy dream.
Well, look, absolutely, and you see in this depiction,
that was unbearable for the audience.
Well, a few things. Firstly, in the depiction, I mean, if you had a Freudian background, and you look at it, you see an elephant, a six-tusked elephant with an upraised trunk entering the belly.
Yeah.
I think, is there any phallic symbolism there? Well, you know. But that's how it fits it. But I think that's very true. But there's like a twofold dynamic. The way that it tends to be depicted from the later tradition is concerned, as you say, to make things crystalline, to make things clean. Like it always says, you know, that when the Buddha was born, that there wasn't any muck or smear, and there wasn't any pain, and all of these kinds of things. And so, in a sense, it's trying to sort of isolate and to depict the Buddha as, or the birth, the heroic birth, as being somehow there's a sort of concern around notions of purity and pollution and so on, right? So that's one aspect of it. But to me, that is a later overlay on that legend and on that motif. The real meaning of that particular motif is the fact that the arrival of the hero signals the arrival of something new. It's something unprecedented. So normally we can explain a son or a daughter through they've come from the parents. You know, this is where they've come from. We can explain them or understand them from where they've come from. But then when something new happens, it's something completely unprecedented. The Buddha was something unprecedented in the world. And so you can't explain it by reference to his parents. So this is, I think, where that motif comes in the story of the hero. I think this is the underlying idea behind the virgin birth idea, is that there's something unprecedented which has appeared in the world. Something, so the Buddha is often called the Swayambhu Nata, is the self-originated one.
I'm a bit mad. Like, it makes him sound like, what he sounds kind of selfish to me.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's all a bit elevated, you know, and not so really big and humble, which I have a little bit of a problem with, that, because if he was going on about how great he was from the time he was born, you know, this guy's obviously got a really big head. He could have changed the world, and maybe he did a bit, but it's a bit much. It's like, why can't you just quietly go about your business? Why do you have to come in and say that you're in bed?
Well, I think he probably just cried, you know, but it doesn't make for such a good story.
Yeah,
baby Buddha was born and went.
Myself, and I'd imagine from most of the group, that's the embellishment of the story is what brought it here.
Right.
To practice of study Buddhism.
Right.
Or the Dharma.
Right, which is very different because the experience of Buddhism from many traditional Buddhists is only the story, yeah, and only the iconography and only those symbols. So it's a very different way of experiencing Buddhism. Yeah, so we could have come and we see these things, and it's kind of a curious kind of thing. I mean, it's like if you came to Christianity. I mean, if you read the teachings of Jesus, and if you became a Christian from reading the teachings of Jesus. And what he actually says in the Gospels, you know, is one thing, and then you turn around and see kind of the Santa Claus in the shopping centre, you know, and think, hang on, how did we get from, you know, from give away everything, you know, anyone who wants to get to find the kingdom has to give away all that they own and follow me, and then we get from there somehow to Santa Claus in a shopping centre? Yeah. So, but it's important. I think it's important to understand, you know, these things because if we have come to it, you know, just from an interest in the teachings and the practice, then we can be very dismissive of those traditional ways of looking at things. You know? But it's important to understand that they have their own role to play as well. They have their own place. Yeah, and you know, for kids who go to the shopping centre, going and see Santa Claus is meaningful. You know. Whereas being told give away everything you own and come and follow me is not. Yeah? so different things are appropriate for different people. Yeah.
I think the approach to telling this kind of story these days would have to be adapted, because I think kids these days will not, you know, find that appealing compared to how it was maybe in the past.
Yeah.
You know, I think kids tend to be a lot more critical, and they like to think they're adults.
Mm. Yeah. Well. Again, this
story is a bit different. It's a bit different from my experience, also, like my neighbour. Things that, you know, we would have found, you know, really appealing and interesting in my generation, like with the kids, is totally different from what she would find interesting. She's much more fascinated by things that adults would really like these days.
And that's always the way, and it's always changed. You know, the you know, for example, we talk about the traditional telling of it, but actually, say in Thailand, the traditional telling of the life of the Buddha was radically changed a couple of hundred years ago. I can't remember the dates of it now, but there was a Thai retelling of the life of the Buddha, and already in those days it was already kind of minimizing the kind of the miraculous and so on events that were surrounding, and sort of introducing this kind of rationalist way of telling it, you know, to some degree, not completely, but those adaptations have always been told. And again, that's one of the things that makes a myth, is that it's retold every generation for every people, tell it in different ways and find new meaning for it.
I can see the valuable place of constructing this narrative of the life of the Buddha in relation to myth, and you know, how that can serve as a means of inspiration and devotion to practicing Buddha. But where do you see the scholarly side of things going in the coming years? I know it's been a lot of progress and, you know, reinterpreting and looking at these texts and being very critical to see the human side of the Buddha. But even now, you know, my experience, a lot of these scholarly texts that I'm reading still talk about the four sides, you know, as though they're a truth, but we're starting to uncover, well, perhaps they weren't.
I mean, look, if you're reading a scholarly text that treats those as if they're facts, then it's not a good scholarly text. I mean, that's not a kind of a speculative thing. That's something that's been obvious since the 19th century. I mean, the simple fact is that a lot of the advances in a sort of, you know, scholarly understanding of Buddhism were actually made in the 19th century and simply haven't filtered into the mainstream. And you know, you can go back and read people like Oldenburg and Rhys Davids in those days, and there's, you know, still many, many great insights there. In terms of the progress of Buddhist studies, you know, the sort of new research in Buddhist studies is that they, for the last few decades, they've more or less abandoned the search for the original Buddha, partly because it kind of got taken as far as it could go, as far as, you know, there's a certain extent where you take that as far as the evidence will bear it, and until, you know, there's more evidence, there's not too much you can say. And in many ways that search was very successful. In many ways it clarified a lot of issues around what's likely to be historical and what isn't, and so on, so it served its purpose. Where the Buddhist studies and scholarship has been less successful, I think, has been in recovering a sense of meaning. And scholarship is good for sort of finding facts, but it's not so good for finding meaning. Yeah? And especially, I mean, this is getting a bit detailed, but especially I think that it's an artifact of it's an artifact of the felt need within contemporary humanities studies to be as rigorous as a science. So rather than having the confidence to be a humanities and to talk about meaning, then you have to be as rigorous as a science. So you sort of, you know, you get into all the details of the linguistics of things and the phonetics of things and all of these kind of scientific or quasi-scientific analyses. And then when it comes to actually reconstructing the spiritual dimension of it, it sort of falls out of the realm of academia, which I think is a bit of a shame. So academia sort of has in a way a bit of a dead end in that respect, and I think that the fact that has happened has also been one of the reasons why those findings, many of which I think are of interest to a wider population, but they haven't found their way into a wider population.
do you think it'll impact the practice?
Oh, already, I'm sure it already has, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Also, when the Buddha left home, like when you learn from the various teachers, if the teachers, did they attain jhana or not?
Well, it seems likely that the... he does. I mean, in both cases with Alarika Lama and Udaka Ramaputta, the text in both cases says that they had samadhi. And samadhi used in the suttas virtually always is a synonym for jhana. So, yeah, it's very likely that they did.
When you read some of the sutras, the Buddha says, oh, they attained... He attained the state that they attained.
Right.
And he said, oh, this is not the way, it's not ultimate.
Yeah.
Then he goes to, you know,
find his own path. That's right, yeah. But the important thing about that is that in those cases, if you remember when the Buddha was a boy and he attained jhana, that was just like there wasn't anything. It was just sitting under a tree. So there wasn't any theory. Right? There wasn't any metaphysics, there wasn't any philosophy, there wasn't any goal. It was just sitting there and his mind just naturally became peaceful. But he didn't know what to do with it. So the fact that there wasn't any theory or there wasn't any understanding around it meant he didn't know where to take it. And when he went in practice with the Brahmanical, presumably Brahmanical teachers, and attained to similar states of samadhi, perhaps even higher states of samadhi, but then they had a metaphysic around that, they had a theory, and it says that very explicitly in the text. First of all, he learnt the texts as far as lip recital and memory would go. Okay, so it's quite explicit in the sutra itself. It says that's what he first did, and then he went to put it into practice. It doesn't tell us what those texts were, but it's very likely that they would have been some kind of perhaps Vedic or Upanishadic texts, which were teaching that if you attain this particular state of consciousness, that is yourself. Yeah, so it's extremely likely that that's the kind of teaching that it was. And so when he reached the end of it, he then said, "This Dhamma is not leading to liberation, it's not leading to the ending of birth, aging and death." So that Dhamma is only leading to rebirth in these particular planes of neither perception nor non-perception or the plane of nothingness. So that Dhamma, of course, is the whole system, it's the whole teaching, the religious system as a whole leads to that, because you practice the jhana with that belief. You believe that this attainment is the realization of its higher self, which will be reborn in some eternal state of bliss. Yeah. So once you've started with that whole dogma, then the system as a whole is unsatisfactory. So this is why he still wasn't satisfied with that. And so then later on, when he realized that, he recollected, actually, that experience of bliss, the actual samadhi experience, doesn't have anything intrinsically to do with that dogma. Okay? Because he had the same experience when he was a kid, and it didn't have anything to do with philosophy or metaphysics or the higher self or anything like that. It's just a state of peacefulness of mind. So this is what I think the difference is between those things. It's when he realized that the state of samadhi is just a state of the nature of the mind. It's not a sort of metaphysical state.
So to reach those formless, that Buddha would have to go through four jhanas first.
Yeah.
You can't actually reach the formless before going through the jhanas.
That's right, yeah.
Can I say something about the last word?
Yeah.
Is the translation a bit skewed because of the differences between the languages? Because it sounds so heavy. and almost sort of communist or something.
Communist.
You guys.
Forwards, comrades, like march into the future.
Drive on diligently if you want to get there. And I just wonder if it's partly to do with the translation.
What about keep on trying? Does that work? How about, yeah, just do it, yeah? Have a cup of tea and a nice lie down? Would that be more suitable? Is that the kind of translation that you were thinking of?
I would think that...
Yes, we can.
Yeah? A little bit more. It sounds like you're depressed. It's all too much. Everything... And I was thinking about that.
Oh, maybe was, yeah, I don't know.
No, when you're talking about...
I think you might be reading a little bit into that, I don't know.
No, the way he was going, like why he went off on his path,
yeah.
It makes him sound a bit neurotic, like, oh my God, everything's falling apart, I've got to find the and, you know, things are out of control, and everything's always changing, I can't cope with it, you know. I just wonder that's the last thing, and make of the, is it really what he said, or is it just what other people put on?
Well, again, I can't say what the fact that it strikes me as being very sounding authentic to me. But
it's almost like knowing that a lot of people won't get that, like, you know, everything's going to change and you just have to keep going.
Yeah.
But if I were him, I might have put something in there about to inspire people a bit, because it's pretty serious. It's like, just thrive on diligently. And there's nothing in there that for me makes me think, oh yeah, you know. It's so flat in a way, as a statement. Just like here. And I probably need something before up here to make me, oh yeah, yeah, I really want to do that. So, you know, so maybe that's just me.
Could possibly be. But no, but to come back to that, I mean, to put that in context, I mean,
just to
leave the communist thing aside. It was a little bit before when Ananda had been thinking, oh, the Buddha's going to die, and he went off to have a good cry.
Yeah.
Yeah. And poor old Ananda, yeah? Ananda's he's the POV character, the point of view character, right? You put in there because you can identify with him. And he goes off and sort of leans against the doorpost. The doorpost, which is very, very, very conveniently appeared in the narrative, because they're in the middle of the bush somewhere, right? So suddenly he's got a doorpost to lean against, right? So it's just a narrative. And the Buddha says, oh, poor Ananda, he calls him back. And then he gives this whole teaching on all of the good qualities of Ananda. Yeah? And so teaches to everybody who's there, you know, Ananda, he's very beloved by everybody for this reason and that reason, and he's very skillful for this reason and that reason. Don't worry, Ananda, you know, you'll soon realize complete enlightenment, yeah? And you'll soon overcome all of your problems. So there's a very personal touch that he's given, and that's not the only, you know, that's one of them, but there's quite a few other details where he's giving this very kind of closed and very caring personal attention, you know, right up to that time of his death.